Welcome to the Edible Community Show in the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains, and if you're a frequent listener, you know that I share this seat with my colleagues, Kate Manchester, she's the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, and Marla Camp, who's the publisher of Edible Austin. Every Monday, thanks to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, we bring you community-based, locally-oriented stories about farmers and growers, chefs and community members, and the food artisans that create the distinct culinary regions we all enjoy throughout the U.S. and Canada. And every season, we're doing the same thing through the pages of the Edible Communities publications. So be sure to check us out at ediblecommunities.com. Today's show is about a topic that I know is on everyone's mind at some point throughout the week, and that's grilling. This time of year, many of us relocate our kitchens out to the porch, deck, or yard, and a grilled cut of meat, fish, or assorted vegetables are often on the menu. Recently, the increased awareness everyone has about eating and sourcing locally has prompted some new questions about the best way to treat our meat. Last week, one of my neighbors actually said to me, "What do I do with this grass-fed beef on the grill? They've been getting some meat from a CSA share, and really you're confused about how to make it taste good." And I actually have had some similar experiences, so I'm very excited about our guest today. I'm going to be joined by Frank Pace, Andy Schloss, and David Joachim. Frank is a chef and master butcher who's been working with the whole animal for several years. He's the resource behind the counter at Healthy Living Market in South Burlington, and he educates shoppers about the different cuts, techniques, and flavors that go into creating a great meal on a daily basis. And I get to have Frank at one of my favorite stores, so I'm lucky to be able to say that. Andy Schloss and David Joachim are co-authors of the New York Times best-selling book, Mastering the Grill, The Owner's Manual for Outdoor Cooking. And as more than one reviewer has stated, this book should become your best friend in the summer or whenever you want to light a fire and get cooking. Andy and David are a dynamic team. They've authored several books together. The most recent one, entitled The Science of Good Food, won an International Association of Culinary Professionals Award this year and was also nominated for a James Beard Award. And then during the last segment of our show, we'll welcome back Charlie Nardozzi, gardener extraordinaire, who will share his wisdom for how to help our plants beat the heat and thrive into fall. So why don't we take a short break? We'll get everyone together, and we'll be right back. Thanks. Welcome back to the Edible Community Show on the Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and our host for today's show, Merrill Lynch, located on the shores of beautiful Lake Champlain in Burlington, Vermont. So our topic today is grilling, and we're going to be focusing on meat. Joining me to lend some expertise are Frank Pace, chef and master butcher at Healthy Living Market in South Burlington, and Andy Schloss, co-author of the New York Times bestseller, Mastering the Grill. And we'll be joined by Andy's co-author a little later in the show. Andy's the author of 15 books, numerous articles, and he's a dedicated teacher committed to streamlining the tedious and illuminating the intricacies that make cooking food a pleasure. He's the owner of more grills than any one person needs, and so I'm eager to learn a little bit about his favorites and what he likes to cook. So welcome, Frank and Andy.
Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Andy, let's start with you. I wanted to ask you about the chapter in your book dedicated to the topic of mastering meat, since we're going to make that our topic today. And it states quite clearly that the quality of any cut depends on the balance of three components, protein, water, and fat. So I wanted you to get us started on what we do when we walk into the store and we try to make sense of all those choices that we have.
Well, there's a lot of ways of choosing. If you're just looking at a steak, regardless of what cut it comes from, what animal it comes from, whatever it comes from, the color of the meat for the type of meat, the darker that meat is, the tougher the meat is likely to be. So that if we're talking about veal, a paler veal is going to be more tender than a redder veal. A paler beef is going to be more tender than a darker beef. Now, the other thing that's tricky about this is tenderness and flavor are inversely proportional in meat. So that the tenderer meat is, the blander it is. One of the big misconceptions people have is the notion of tender, flavorful meat. It doesn't exist. The more exercise a muscle gets, the tougher that muscle becomes, and the more flavorful it becomes.
So actually, the notion of people going out and looking for that tender steak at those fancy steakhouses is really not the way meat was meant to be.
Well, I mean, I think what it is if the tenderest cut, for instance, is from the tenderloin or the fillet in the in the cattle. And what that muscle is, that muscle actually runs parallel to the spine inside the animal, underneath the loin, so that if you're looking, if you are using yourself as a cattle and you put your hand on your back, the muscle that you are feeling is your loin. On the inside of that, which would be on, again, also running parallel to it on the spine, would be your tenderloin. Now, that is the muscle that allows you to arch your back, which is something that cattle never, ever do. So it is a completely underused muscle. What it produces is this extremely tender, cut it with a fork kind of meat, but a meat that is relatively bland. Now, in our country, we value tenderness so much more than flavor that we're willing to pay premium price for this meat that we can cut with a fork, and we sort of convince ourselves that it tastes great, even though a shoulder, a chuck, which is much cheaper, tastes a lot better.
And what do you think about that, Frank? I mean, are you finding customers come in and the thing they want the most is the tenderness? Or
absolutely. I totally agree because of the I mean, from my understanding, it's definitely fat content within the whole animal, which, you know, there's the way Andy was talking about, the lightness, I believe, comes from the amount of fat that's in the food. Like, the animals are sitting in feedlots for most of the time, so they're not moving. And so the way the customer buys is based on that. Like, through Middle America, we have based our knowledge on the tenderness, and it's totally due. They just packed all these animals into feedlots, and they just sit there, and they don't run around, they don't do anything, they just get fatter and fatter and fatter.
So the same way that tenderloin, I'm sorry, Andy, go ahead.
No, I was just saying, and they don't develop flavor that way. If exercise is what makes a meat flavorful, sitting in a feedlot doesn't help the flavor of the meat very much.
Absolutely.
Although what Frank was saying about fat does help the flavor. The striation of fat through meat does contribute to flavor. And we can talk a little bit about the difference between the flavor that comes from fat and the flavor that comes from the lean.
Which I'd love for you to talk about, because I think some of that is a result of the feed, right, which would then lead us into our grass-fed, corn-fed debate. So share with us a little about that difference in the fat.
Well, fat, almost all flavors in the world, flavors in grass, flavors in corn, flavors in herbs, flavors in anything, are fat-soluble, which means that they are transmitted through fat. So fat in an animal becomes one of the more flavorful elements in the meat. When you talk about marbling, which is fat that is internalized through the lean of a muscle, that happens, as Frank described it, from when an animal gets a lot more calories than it needs, it first deposits those extra calories in fat around the muscles. That's why when you cut into a steak, that fat that's around the muscle on the outside of the meat, that's adipose tissue, which is fat-storing tissue. If the animal continues to get more calories than it needs, the fat no longer can be stored in the adipose tissue, and it starts being stored inside the muscle tissue. What that does, that's called marbling. And in the life of an animal, that makes you terribly unhealthy. It's what happens, like, when people are obese, they have fat stored in their organs and stored in their muscles, and it makes the muscles inefficient, and it makes the organs break down. However, it makes them very delicious when they're butchered. so what happens is that fat that's interlaced through the meat, even though it's not great for the health of the animal, is exactly the fat that makes the meat taste good. The meat on the outside doesn't do a lot for the flavor of the meat. It sort of protects it in storage, and it protects it a little bit on the grill. But if you think about a steak grilling on a grill, most of that fat that's on the outside is just going to drip into the flame. It's not going to actually affect the flavor of the meat. It's the fat that's sort of striated through the lean that's going to give it all that flavor.
So what does that mean for if a person who wants to be eating something that's humanely raised and healthy? Does that mean that we don't really have a choice for flavorful meat, or?
Well, the other side of it is that the more exercise an animal gets, the more flavorful its lean muscle gets. So an animal that is grass-fed and roaming around in pasture land gets a lot more exercise than an animal that's sitting still and eating corn. The animal that's sitting still and eating corn is going to get more fat, more marbling, and get flavor that way. The animal that's grazing is going to get more, it's actually going to build up protein, more protein in its lean, and get flavor that way. The flavors are quite different, and I think that's the major difference between the flavor of grass-fed beef and the flavor of corn-fed beef. Is in corn-fed beef, you're basically tasting the flavor of fat. In grass-fed beef, you're tasting the flavor of lean.
Well, and I actually wanted to ask Frank, because I know, you know, you sell a lot of the grass-fed product, and what are some of your customers' reactions when they first try it?
When we talk to new customers who have tried it, they're definitely skeptical about it. It's been a long time coming to educate the customer on the benefits of grass-fed beef, because there is still a majority of our population because we offer corn-fed that is raised in Vermont, and we offer grass-fed finished. So it's definitely split on who wants corn-fed and who wants grass-fed. The demographics of people that are taking grass-fed beef is, a younger crowd, definitely more people that are more into their health and definitely like beef but don't want to eat corn, you know.
So there's actually health benefits. Andy, there's some health benefits to grass-fed, not just flavor benefits?
Well, it's less fatty, for sure. There is some evidence that you're actually getting more omega-3s in grass-fed beef, because there's a lot of omega-3s in grass. So that animals that are fed more on grass seem to have more omega-3 fatty acids in their meat than the corn-fed animals. And I think that's the biggest... Those are probably the biggest difference, and then the other difference is animals that are fed for long periods of time in feedlots. I would say like over 3 months, which is pretty typical, would be given antibiotics, because one of the things in feedlots is that animals are packed together so closely they tend to exchange diseases more. There's also some evidence that just the feeding of a cattle on corn, which is not the feed that its stomach is made for, tends to disrupt the animal's physiology and make it more prone, weakens it, and tends to make it more prone to disease. So as far as antibiotics goes, there's a necessity to have antibiotics in corn-fed beef. There is not a necessity in grass-fed beef, although sometimes that is done as well. One thing about antibiotics is even in feedlot beef, antibiotics are not fed to the cattle within 3 days of butchering. So that what the premise of that is that there will not be antibiotics in the muscle tissue at the time of slaughter. But it gets the antibiotics for a good long time of its life.
Well, maybe this is a good time to ask you then, because you have a nice section in the book about this. Some of these terms, you know, organic, humanely raised, I mean, there's trying to find the right cut, right, which we could keep talking about as well, but then there's all these labels trying to figure out how do I prioritize, you know, what's the most important?
It's not easy because it's not terribly regulated. There is a USDA program for sponsoring beef grass-fed, and to get a USDA certification for that, it has to be 100% fed on pasturage. There can be no corn feeding at all. If it doesn't have a USDA seal for it, however, it is legal to call something grass-fed if it is fed on grass even for a small part of its life, and there's no regulation about that. So the only real regulation we have is that if it has a USDA label that says it's been grass-fed. Grass-fed also doesn't necessarily mean that the meat is organic. As I said before, you can grass-feed an animal and still give it antibiotics. Mm-hmm. If they meat is USDA National Organic, then it has to be fed completely on organic feed. That means that it can't have any GMOs in its feed or anything like that, or have it can have vitamin and mineral supplements, but that's it. It could be corn and it could be grass. Organic doesn't necessarily mean grass-fed. You could be fed on organic corn. It's not been given hormones to promote growth, and it's never been given antibiotics. It's given access to pasture. Now, this is a weird thing. Access basically means that it can go out to pasture. It doesn't necessarily mean that it does go out to pasture. And that's what organic means.
And so, Frank, what would you tell folks who are sort of, where would you start them if they were coming in and they were saying, okay, we've been used to those tender corn-fed Midwestern steaks. What would you lead them toward if they were going to try, if they were looking to find their way through all of this?
Well, what we offer is a farm called Boyden Farm, where it's started on grass, and they feed on pasture, but they're given their own corn that he raises on the farm. And I tend to usually give them send them towards that. And then as they get along in time, then, you know, hey, we have this grass-fed beef, this Hardwick, which is 100% grass-finished, and that's all. It's not organic, but we also offer some organic, like we have organic grass that's certified because it's a dairy.
Mm-hmm.
So in order, like a lot of the farms that we have there are dairy farms that, you know, call their cattle and sell it as beef,
mm-hmm.
which is, so that's certified organic. And but mostly what I would do for them is, you know, give them the corn-fed, like on grass, the Boyden Farm, which is a very good quality
mm-hmm.
beef.
Andy, is that choice available throughout the country in your experience?
I think that's
folks?
A pretty common way to do it, and it's actually a really good way because people are used to the flavor of corn-fed beef. And we're, you know, as we're saying, it's that flavor of this rich, fatty beef. And if you switch directly to grass-fed, it can really taste sort of gamey, and
yeah.
it can be tougher. And protein, when you're getting the flavor all from protein, there's a proteins are sort of smelly. They have a real overt flavor to them that is off-putting to people who aren't used to it. So this sort of transitional meat where you're getting something that has a little bit more flavor from being on pasturage more of the time, but it's finished on corn so it gets a little bit of marbling into it, is a good way to sort of transition out of that real long feedlot beef. I mean, traditionally, feedlot beef could be done, an animal could live 6 months in a feedlot, which, you know, these ones that are finished on corn are probably in there for, what, Frank, like a month or so, or six
yep.
weeks?
We have, we have two farms in Vermont, Wood Creek and La Platte, and that's a two-month process that they're finished
mm-hmm.
on. And La Platte does corn, sorghum, and alfalfa in his blend.
Right. Alfalfa is something that a lot of beef in Europe get, and it's one of the characteristic flavors of Italian and French beef is feeding on alfalfa.
And I was going to ask you that, Andy, because you had mentioned that when we spoke a little earlier in the week that European beef is generally grass-fed beef, and often people from our country will travel over there, taste something and not think it tastes quite like ours, but not realize that it's actually the product itself, the beef itself, and not just the way it's prepared.
Absolutely. I mean, some of the best beef in the world is Argentinian beef, and that has always been 100% grass-fed.
Now, what about some cuts? We're getting to, we have about 5 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you what you might recommend people start with. If they want to make this transition and go to sort of this grass-fed, getting out of the big, thick steak approach, what are some of your suggestions and places for them to start?
Well,
maybe a hamburger?
I would never switch off from big thick steaks, even if I was going to grass fed. But it, I would say you stay with the cuts that you know, and cuts really are more a question of how you're going to cook it than anything else. And as we were saying, that the more exercise a muscle gets, the tougher that meat is and the more flavorful it is. So a steak that's coming from the shoulder, which on beef would be the chuck, that is a meat that is really, really flavorful, but is way too tough to grill as a steak. Even though it's called a chuck steak, you can't just put it on the grill. Because what happens when a meat is exercised is that there's connective tissue between the muscle fibers that gets real thick and tough. And that isn't going to tenderize in the time it takes to grill something. In order to tenderize that connective tissue, you have to cook it with a little moisture. So a chuck is better to, if you want to cook it on over a fire, it's better to barbecue. And barbecuing is a real slow method of cooking, but we'll get to that in your second half, but you'll talk more about barbecuing. But for those tough cuts, you don't want to directly grill them. You want to indirect grill them or cook them, basting them with a mop so that they get a lot of moisture, which really softens that connective tissue. And that's where you get this real sort of succulent meat in the tough ones. Chuck, as far as hamburger goes, I would recommend chuck as the cut for hamburger, that because it is the most flavorful, and it has, and it's the toughest. But when you grind the meat up for hamburger, it doesn't matter how tough it was to begin with, because you're breaking up all that connective tissue. So chuck makes much better hamburger than sirloin does. And ground sirloin costs a lot more than ground chuck does. Ground sirloin is sort of mushy and not nearly as beefy as ground chuck.
And what about grinding your meat at home? I know some folks have started doing that also. Do you think that makes a big difference in the quality?
No. I would think, I don't know, unless you have a real great meat grinder, and I'm not sure what advantage it would be. I think maybe people are doing it because they want to control the amount of fat that's in it or something like that. But I would much rather have a butcher do it. I was just saying, if you've got a good butcher who you trust, they're
like
going to... like Frank. They're going to grind it to the right amount of fat. So, I mean, there's nothing wrong with grinding meat yourself, but I don't think there's a great advantage to freshly grinding it, as long as, if you buy it at a good butcher and use it that day, that's perfectly fresh enough.
Great. And what are you going to be grilling this weekend?
What am I grilling?
Maybe it won't
weekend?
Be beef, huh?
Well, I just grilled, I was just down at the, down in North Carolina at the beach, and somebody gave me a giant tuna loin. So
wow.
I'm going to just take the whole tuna loin and I think like plug it with basil leaves, and then I'm going to wrap it in like Szechuan seasoning, and then grill the whole loin so that I can char the outside but keep the center real rare.
And we'll learn more about the techniques when we talk to David, right, about you'll be doing, direct or indirect.
Yes, he's the fireman.
Well, that really, it sounds like a delicious recipe. It's good we're not going to be giving your address over the air, and we'll all be coming to join you for that.
It is a really big tuna loin.
So we might be able to get there.
Yeah, Frank, I might be able to
Frank
feed a couple hundred off of that.
Do you prefer grass-fed or corn-fed?
It actually depends what I'm cooking. I think I have a butcher who sells really nice grass-fed beef. I think the problem I have mostly with grass-fed is inconsistencies of
Absolutely.
Quality in it.
They don't. That's what I've found in the last 6 years is the farms that finish the animal long enough, then we don't have a problem. But it's
right.
a matter of how they finish the animal.
Right, and it's simply because pasturage is inconsistent. There is no way of really getting a consistent product when an animal is feeding just on pasturage. But the corn feeding does even the differentials out, and it makes it a much more consistent product.
So on that note, I'm going to thank you for joining us.
It was fun.
It was great speaking with you, and I look forward to having you back. You've got so many great things you can speak to us about, and I know you have a new book coming out, so we'll have to be sure we get together when that happens. So thanks a lot, and happy grilling. Good luck with that tuna loin.
Thank you. Bye.
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 Welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. You're listening to the Edible Community Show, and I'm your host, Deborah Shapiro. I want to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, for making today's program possible. And if you're just joining us, we're speaking about a popular summer topic, grilling. I'm here with Frank Pace. He's the master chef and butcher at Healthy Living Market. And David Joachim, who's the co-author with our earlier guest, Andy Schloss, of the New York Times bestseller, Mastering the Grill. David claims to be a pyromaniac from birth, and he's collaborated or authored more than 25 cookbooks, including the award-winning Food Substitutions Bible and the A Man a Can series. He also lists a leaf blower as one of his favorite cooking tools, and I'm hoping he'll tell us why. So welcome, Frank and David.
Hi, Deborah.
Thank you.
David, Andy just shared some insights for how to select the best ingredients, and when you and I spoke the other day, I had shared my experience about the grilled meat disaster. Remember, the meat was grass-fed, I'd frozen it, I marinated it, then I grilled it, and it was just awful. And you had a great explanation, and I thought that might be a good place for us to start, is maybe you could tell people what I did wrong.
Well, I'm not sure if you talked earlier about the difference between grass-fed and grain-fed meat, but that does make a difference. Grass-fed meat tends to be a little leaner, so it often cooks a little quicker, and because it's leaner, it has less fat, and it will taste sometimes a little less moist than the very rich, well-marbled grain-fed meat. So in that case, you may want to add something that's a little moist, like a sauce or a glaze that is adding moisture to that grass-fed meat. The other thing that you mentioned is that you froze the meat, and when meat freezes, the water in the meat cells expands and it ruptures those cells, and then when you defrost the meat, you're losing some moisture there. So those are the two things that probably made the meat a little dry, and if you overcooked it, then they would make it even drier.
Right, and I wasn't the actual person grilling, but I'm still going to take some of the blame for that. So I have in my notes that we were going to talk a little about the myth of marinade, and then I thought you could, from that, we hear you are the fire guy, so you could kind of lead us a little into what effect that'll have, and then we'll get Frank's feeling about that, too.
Okay, sure. Well, marinade is a very popular flavoring method. Typically, it's some sort of acid-based liquid mixture, and by acid I mean lemon juice or vinegar. So let's take an Italian vinaigrette as an example, a very common marinade. What's happening there is that the acid is helping to break down the fibers of the protein in the meat, and that helps to tenderize it somewhat, but this is where we'll get into the myth of it. It also helps to flavor the meat somewhat by breaking down those tissues. The problem is that it only penetrates about a 16th of an inch into the point of contact. So even if you inject the marinade with a needle injector into the meat, you're still only getting marinade about a 16th or a maximum of an 1/8 of an inch from the point of contact. So you're really not flavoring the meat that much, and it also doesn't tenderize the meat that much because of that very shallow penetration area. And this is what I think is somewhat misleading about marinades, is that the whole piece of meat is going to taste like whatever you marinated in, and it really doesn't. It only flavors the surface, which is not necessarily bad, but you may want to couple a marinade with a spice rub or a sauce to really make something taste flavorful. A marinade on its own is often not enough.
Well, and I know that there's some places, not where Frank is, of course, but there are some places that seem to sell marinated meat that's been in there probably for days, because when you actually, if you cook it, the texture is completely different on the inside.
Yeah, well, a lot of those are actually brined. Brine in a marinade is that the action in a marinade, that tenderizing action we talked about, is the force of acid working on the... But in a brine, that action is done by salt. You think of a brine like the ocean of any briny water. It's basically salt water. That's what a brine is. And a brine is much more effective at penetrating the flavors and creating the effect that people want when they marinate food. So a lot of those pre-marinated
meats, let's say a pork tenderloin, for instance, that's cryovac'd with a marinade mixture, is actually fairly high in salt, so it will get a really good flavor penetration.
So that's the secret.
Yeah, the salt works a little differently. It opens up the protein so it can absorb more moisture. And the biggest benefit of brining is that when you grill meat that's been brined, it will taste juicier after it's been cooked than a piece of meat that has not been brined. And that's because the salt will open up the proteins and allow it to hang on to more moisture. And this is a huge benefit for something like pork, which is very, very low in moisture to begin with and very easy to dry out on the grill. So when we do ribs in Mastering the Grill, the ribs recipes are all brined because it improves the moisture so much and keeps you from getting that dry, leathery, tough rib that's tough to chew.
Mm-hmm. And so one reason people don't do that is probably time, right? There's the time consideration of having to plan ahead if you're the busy person coming home and you think, oh, I'll just put it in a marinade for an hour.
Yeah.
But you don't get those results. Now, once we've marinated or brined, where are you on this whole gas versus charcoal kind of topic?
I'm right in the middle. I use both.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. gas and charcoal both have their advantages. It's really a matter of the fuel and what it brings to the table. Gas is undeniably convenient. I use gas mostly on weekdays because I don't have as much time. Charcoal is undeniably flavorful, but it takes a little more time and a little more management of the fuel source itself when you're cooking. And here's the basic difference. With a gas grill, let's go back to any fire. Fire is just energy that is released when one substance mixes rapidly with another. So what's happening whenever you have a fire is that oxygen is mixing so rapidly with whatever your fuel source is, let's say it's propane for gas, that it gives off heat and that we harness that heat for cooking. In a gas grill, that oxygen to fuel ratio is completely automated. So you don't have to add more oxygen to the fire like you would have to do with a campfire, for instance, or a charcoal grill. It's automated, so you just turn the knob up and down and you get lower high heat. That's what makes it so simple, and that's why it's the number one type of grill in America. Most people have gas grills. Charcoal grills, on the other hand, require a little more maintenance. You have to add oxygen to make sure the fire keeps going, and you have to add oxygen to increase the heat or take oxygen away to lower the heat, and you do that with the vents and the lid. The vents will allow more oxygen to flow if they're open, and if they're closed, they will slow down the oxygen flow, which is essentially lowering the heat level. So it takes a little more maintenance with a charcoal grill. But now we get into the real fun stuff. Gas is partially moisture. It's hydrogen. Propane gas is partially hydrogen, and for every hour of grilling, you are releasing about half a cup of moisture, of water vapor, into your grill with the lid down. And people wonder why you can't get a great crust on a steak on a gas grill. This is why, because you're partially steaming it. Gas is releasing moisture as it burns, and that moisture is preventing you from getting that great dry crust that you want on the outside of a steak. It also only burns at about 550 to 600 degrees. You're not going to get a gas grill much hotter than that. Charcoal, on the other hand, burns very, very hot. It burns at about 900 degrees. So you're getting higher heat, which is giving you better dehydration on the surface. You actually want to dry out the surface a little bit to create that great crust, but more so to allow browning to happen. Browning is what makes grilled food taste so good, and it doesn't happen until about 350 degrees, and as we know, moisture is not going to get above 212. So you have to get rid of the moisture, and that's why a gas grill is not as good at browning foods and searing a steak as a charcoal grill is. So if you're looking for flavor, charcoal is the way to go.
And for all those folks, though, who have a gas grill, is there a technique you could recommend, though, to get it a little closer to the charcoal experience?
You definitely want to preheat your grill so it is as hot as possible. Crank it up to high, put the lid down and preheat it for at least 15 minutes. You want the grill grate especially to be very, very hot. So let's say you're trying to get a great crust on a steak over a gas grill. There are a few things you can do. One is to preheat the grill, like I mentioned. The other is to let your meat rest at room temperature for about 20 minutes before cooking it, because warm meat will sear much better than cold meat. That's because of the steam that's created when something hot meets something cold. So if your meat is a little warmer, it's going to sear much better. The other thing is to pat dry all the surfaces of your steak. Remember, we're trying to get rid of moisture on the surface. We want it dry so it will brown and develop a great crust. So pat dry the surface of that steak that you've let rest at room temperature. Better yet, put a dry rub on it. That will absorb some more moisture. And when you're going to grill, make sure that you scrape the grill grate clean and lubricate it with a paper towel that's been dipped in some vegetable oil. That
before
will also
it
help
on.
You get some really good sear marks on the steak. You should treat your grill grate just like you would a sauté pan. You would never cook anything in a dirty sauté pan. After you're done cooking in it, you clean it. Well, you should do the same thing with your grill. Right after food comes off the grill, scrape it. That's when the food is hot. It'll come off easily. You won't have problems with these carbonized black bits sticking to your grill grate. Scrape it then, and then when you go to your next grilling session, you fire up the grill, you let it preheat, give it another quick scrape, but more importantly, rub it with this oily paper towel, which will lubricate it, it'll help prevent sticking, and it will get off those fine bits of soot and ash that might be stuck to the grill grate. And it'll help to season your grill grate also, so it'll be more nonstick in the long run.
And I'm sure you've seen they now have these aerosol cans of spray just for the grill. Have you seen that? And
yes, I
guess
have.
You would tell us we don't want to bother, right? Don't go in that direction.
Yeah, I don't bother with those. I mean, you could use a little chunk of fat. Let's say you've trimmed a piece of beef. You're trimming off some fat from a steak, for instance. You could take that little chunk of fat and rub that over the surface of the grill grate. You really don't need to buy an extra product that's canned aerosol fat. You can just... there are many sources of fat in our world, so
just choose one.
All you need to do is to lubricate those grill grates. It's not that important which kind of fat you use. I use cheap vegetable oil. I keep it in a little empty peanut butter jar near my grill, and it's very easy to use.
That's a great suggestion. Now, how about direct and indirect heat? That's something else I hear a lot about.
Yeah, direct grilling is what most people are familiar with. Light a fire, put food over it. You are direct grilling. The meaning there is that you're grilling directly over the heat. The advantage of a covered grill, which was the great breakthrough with the kettle grill that was invented in the 50s and has now become the big icon of backyard grilling in America, it's this bowl-shaped kettle grill. The lid is so important to that because it traps the heat. If you think about direct grilling, all of the heat is coming from below. It's hitting your food, and then it's just escaping into the air. Well, the lid traps that heat and harnesses it, and it allows you to do other grilling techniques on your grill. And with a lid on, you can turn your grill into something more like an oven, and you can do things like oven roasting or indirect grilling, where you put a piece of food away from the heat. And what you do in this case is instead of laying your coal bed out evenly across the entire bottom of your grill, you pile the coals to one side. Or if you're using a gas grill, you only turn on one or two burners on one side, and then you leave the other ones off. You preheat the grill with the lid down as you normally would, and then you put the food on the unheated side of your grill. And when you put the lid down, you've got convection heat rolling that heat all around your grill, especially in a kettle-shaped grill, which is an efficient way of delivering heat to all surfaces of the food, not just the part that's facing the coal bed. So you can see this is how you can cook something like a chicken or a turkey on your grill. You can do, we often call it grill roasting, and you can grill braise. You can do almost any method that you would do in a typical oven on your grill by using the lid and the indirect method.
So that's a reason for folks to get out there and make sure they have all sorts of tools.
Yeah, so well, you can do this with any grill. You need any special tools. You just need to use it a little differently. Instead of turning on all your burners and putting the food directly over the heat, you only turn on a couple of burners or pyre your coals to one side, and then you put the food on the unheated side and put the lid down. It just allows you to cook something bigger, like a roast.
Or Andy was just telling us about his loin of tuna. So, so that might be something he'll do that way. I'm going to ask Frank to chime in now on the topic of doneness and sort of how, because he has a chef's background as well as his butchering background. And how do you know when it's done? I know there's holding your hand over the fire. There's.
You're talking about meat?
Yeah.
Preferably, for steaks, I do it all by touch. I was taught a system with my hand, and you squeeze your hand, and you can. The hand, if it's relaxed, is rare, and if it's if you hold it, it's about mid rare, and then if you squeeze it tight, be like medium, mid well.
And if you were here with us, you'd see that Frank is sort of making a mini fist, and he's sort of touching that part where your thumb sort of wraps around. And do you have something more scientific, Dave? Or
we often use temperature as the most accurate reading of doneness, but I think Frank's suggestion is great because most people are just using visual cues, and there are good visual cues for when meat is done. It's just a matter of getting used to them and knowing what the doneness cues are, and that touch test that he just explained is very good because your hand, your fist, is meat. It is muscle. Meat is muscle. And when it's relaxed, it's soft, like a piece of raw meat. But when it's tensed up, it's firm, like a piece of cooked meat. When meat cooks, it dries out, the proteins coagulate or come together and make it actually shrinks, it loses some moisture, and it makes the whole piece of meat firmer and a little bit smaller and a little bit drier. That's what happens when it cooks. So you need to look for those cues. If you poke a steak and it's very soft and you can push a quarter of an inch in with your fingertip, it's probably pretty rare inside. If you poke it with your fingertip a little later and it's a little firmer and you can't go in as far, then you're probably getting closer to medium rare or medium. And it's just a matter of getting used to what it feels like. But the temperature test is a little more accurate. And we use pretty standard temperatures for rare and medium rare and medium well.
And you're supposed to put the thermometer in on the side, right? So that you don't
pierce the top. Yes, for a thin piece of meat like a steak or a burger or something, you put the thermometer through the side so you make sure you're not poking the thermometer all the way through the piece of food and then getting a reading of your grill below.
So we're just about ready to take a short break, but you must tell us, why is a leaf blower one of your favorite cooking tools?
Well, let's go back to what fire is. Fire is oxygen mixing rapidly with another substance and giving off heat. Well, if you have some green wood or dry wood, or you have a charcoal grill that you just can't wait to get lit, what you need to do is add more oxygen. If you flood that mixture that you've got with oxygen, you're going to stoke the fire. And this is the whole principle behind a bellows that was used for ages to get the fire going. Well, a leaf blower is like a bellows on steroids. You plug in your leaf blower, turn it on, and blow that air right into your fire. You'll be amazed at how quickly your fire will just start raging because oxygen is the key element. A fire is oxidation. It's the oxidation of that fuel source. So let's say it's charcoal. What's happening is oxygen in the air is mixing, after it's ignited, it's mixing with that fuel, with the charcoal briquettes. All you're doing is speeding the process along by adding extra oxygen when you use a leaf blower or a magazine in a strong hand or if you blow on it. It really helps to understand that fire is oxidation, and then you can see why a leaf blower is just my favorite cooking tool because you can get a fire going in just a couple of minutes.
Well, I'm excited to try that and to tell more people about it. Thank you so much, Dave.
Oh, thank you.
I think we could talk to you, Andy, and Frank for the whole week. And not, we've only been on meat. I should have said something at the beginning of the show that we were focusing on meat because there's a lot to say about everything we could put on the grill, and we'll have to have you all come back.
That would be great.
Thanks so much, and have fun with that leaf blower and whatever you're going to be grilling this weekend.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks. We'll take a short break, and we'll be back with Charlie Nardozzi. Welcome back to our show. I'm Deborah Shapiro, publisher of Edible Green Mountains, and your host for the Edible Community Show here on the Heritage Radio Network. I want to thank our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and of course our host today, Merrill Lynch, on the shores of beautiful Lake Champlain. So it's been wet and cool and hot and dry. What's a gardener to do? Well, I have the answer. We're going to ask Charlie Nardozzi. And those of you who've been with me on the show before know that Charlie began gardening, they say 40 years ago, and now that I have the chance to meet him, I think that can't be true. He can't even be 40 years old yet. But he was a very young child, and he followed his grandfather around and helped him hill potatoes and tie up tomatoes. And, of course, if you know anything about what's going on in Vermont's growing season, tomatoes are really suffering right now. But he's the spokesperson for the National Gardening Association and an author and a media personality, and he's found some time to come sit and talk with us. And we're excited. Hi, Charlie.
Hi, Deborah.
How are you?
I'm doing really well, especially now that it's warm and sunny out.
Finally, warm and sunny again. So what should folks be doing with their garden right now? I know that you really believe in a replanting process. So.
Yes, this is actually the right in the middle of the second season of planting is what I call it. And even for a northern gardener in a place like Vermont or Wisconsin, Montana, places where it's cold, even in the summer sometimes, you can plant two or three crops a year and actually have multiple seasons where you're harvesting from your garden. And this is the ideal time to be planting a lot of the cool season things as you head into September and October. So you could be planting beets, for example, some of the short season carrots, any kind of greens, Swiss chard, spinach, lettuce, mesclun mixes. Lots of different things can be planted now so that you can continue the harvest going forward so that when the first frost comes in October or November, depending on where you are, you don't have to just kind of give up the ghost. Some of these crops will actually take a frost and keep producing.
And should we be concerned? You know, there's been a lot about the blight with tomatoes, potatoes. What about folks wanting to go if they've had any of that in their yard, if they've pulled out the tomatoes and want to put something new in? Mm-hmm. Is there an issue with that?
Yes, there's been a big problem with blight in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic, even into the Midwest this summer. Some of the plants that were originally shipped out in the spring were infected with late blight, which is famous or infamous, I should say, for the Irish potato famine back in the 1840s. And so the combination of that early infection with the really cool, wet, rainy weather that we've had in the eastern part of the country this year has really set that blight going all over the place, and it's killed lots of tomatoes and potatoes all around this region. So the thing you need to do, of course, is to rip those out because the blight is very contagious. If you don't get all the plants out this year, it'll be back next year to infect your plants.
So in terms of this replanting, if somebody ripped out their tomatoes, would they use that soil to plant one of these new crops?
Absolutely, because it's going to only affect tomato family crops, and really it's most specific towards potatoes and tomatoes. So even peppers and eggplant don't get it as much. So if you've ripped out those plants already and you've got this barren ground there, put some compost down, maybe a little half-inch layer, work it into the soil, and start planting because you can keep planting right for another month or two.
Wonderful. And what are some of the things that you would encourage people to think about? I mean, what will do really well? for folks now?
Well, anything that's a cool season crop that you don't have to let mature into a fruit. You know, most of the warm season things that we're eating now, the summer mm-hmm. squashes and cucumbers and tomatoes and peppers, they all have to form into a fruit. And that takes a lot of energy and a lot of time.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're just eating the leaf of something or the root of something, those kinds of crops take less amount of time, so those will mature quicker. And especially if they're adapted to cool temperatures, you can plant any of the leafy greens, a lot of the root crops now, and still get a nice crop of those.
And where would people go to find some of those resources? Are they still out there? I know a lot of the gardening places sort of, they go, there's a lot of mums, but I haven't seen a lot of...
Yeah, a lot of garden centers are kind of winding down as far as finding seed or transplants. You can check your local area. You might find it there. There's a lot of mail order companies, though, that are actually doing a lot more selling this time of year. Johnny Selected Seeds is one of my favorites over in Maine. We get a lot of seed from them every year. There's a smaller company over in Maine called Pine Tree Garden Seeds, and they're nice because they'll sell you a small packet of seeds. So if you want to try that special variety of arugula that you've heard about, but you don't want to pay $3 for it, you just want to pay 90 cents, you mm-hmm. can get a little special packet of that and try that in the garden. So through the Internet, a lot of these companies are really quick with their turnaround. You order it today, literally within a couple of days, you'll have the seed in your mailbox.
And then you'll have a nice salad to look forward to.
Exactly.
Which would be great.
There is another way to do this, too, and that's to hold things a little bit longer into the season. And a person I really like reading about and seeing his operation is Elliot Coleman in Maine. And what he does a lot, he calls it not so much extending the growing season, but extending the harvest season. So it's protecting plants as it gets cooler. So if you have broccoli out there, if you have leeks out there, even if you have some of the warm season things, beans and stuff like that, you can protect them with cold frames, with row covers, get them through a couple frosts, maybe in September, October, early November, and then we get Indian summer. Hey, and it gets warm again, and everyone gets out there with their shorts again for a week or two. But you can get more crops that way, and you can extend that season in a different fashion.
Now, what do you have in your garden that you're enjoying right now?
Right now?
Uh-huh.
Lots of summer squash. I should have brought you some.
I wish you had.
Lots of summer squashes. One I particularly like called the Coosa summer squash, which is a light green skin. It's also called a Lebanese summer squash. It doesn't get as big as a zucchini. It has more of a nuttier flavor to it. And even when it gets big, it doesn't have a big seed cavity. It doesn't have a lot of seeds to it. So I really like that one. Cucumbers are just pouring in. I'm even getting tomatoes. How about that?
And why do you think you're getting tomatoes? What did you do to safeguard against?
I think the garden gods were just smiling on me. That's all.
Really?
Yeah, I think
it's
indiscriminate.
It's not really.
Yeah, it was kind of here and there, and I am starting to get some, but it's not going to be a very big crop this year, so unfortunately I won't be able to can as much as I normally do.
Mm-hmm.
But we just finished our last crop of beans, and now our pole beans are starting to come in. And instead of traditional pole beans, I like growing the asparagus beans or the yard-long beans. And these are real
Japanese or Chinese?
Yes,
those?
They're Chinese.
Yeah,
and there's one that I love to grow called red noodle. And it's a dark burgundy red color, and it hangs down in pairs. And when you cook it, it keeps that dark burgundy red color. In fact, it gets a little more dark or darker
mm-hmm.
as you cook it. So it's a really beautiful thing to look at and very tasty and grows really well in the garden.
And what's one of your favorite recipes for all these? Since we are the edible community show, what's one of the ways you like to prepare your...
Well, I like to keep things really simple. So summer squash with maybe a little garlic and butter in a pan, just kind of saute it with salt and pepper, that's great for me. For the beans, especially the Chinese or the Asian beans, I like to use Szechuan sauces and soy sauces. Maybe I'm a vegetarian, so maybe some tofu or something like that mixed in too. But I don't like to add a lot of flavors and make it really complicated. A lot of the flavors in the garden are just so beautiful this time of year. It's good to enjoy them for what they are.
And I'm smiling if you were here with me because we just had that whole show about meat. And I've just learned that Charlie's a vegetarian, which...
But I noticed in the Mastering the Grill book that I could do stuffed French toast on my grill. So there.
Oh, that's very exciting. Well, and there's lots of vegetable recipes in
there. Yes, there are.
Too. So what else should we be telling people? Because I've got a lot of friends who are sort of concerned about their gardens right now, kind of, you know, there's all this stamina at the beginning of the season, and now they're sort of losing a little
people
of their enthusiasm.
People are losing steam and their enthusiasm.
Yeah, things are getting leggy, you know.
Yeah,
kinda,
yeah. I think what I was mentioning before about replanting is a good idea, and also pulling things out when they're done. We have a habit, especially as a beginning gardener, people have a very soft heart. and they see one little bean out there, one little flower, and they think, oh, I can't pull the beans out yet. They've got a few more left. If you can get a little more hard-hearted about it and just go in there and rip them out when they're done with their main crop, that'll give you the opportunity to come in with a second crop or a third crop. So cleaning up the garden that way not only allows you to plant more, but it also does clean up the garden. You can weed a little bit better that way. You can mulch your pathways. I just finished mulching for a second time this summer with a straw in my pathways, and that's nice, especially in the rain, because it's easier to walk through there, and you're not spreading diseases around, and it keeps the weeds out.
That's a great suggestion. I'm guilty of that. But when I see a little something still living or a little flower still living.
Yeah, you don't want to pull it out. But really, you got to think of it in terms of production. We can produce a lot from a little piece of land.
And then, or as someone once said to me, though, I was saying something about pulling out a weed or a flower, and they said, well, just because they don't have eyes and feet that you can see doesn't mean they don't feel it. So we have both sides. That sort of speaks to the heart a little bit. Well, I also wanted to ask you about, you talked about just having mulched, but I also wanted to ask you a little bit about home composting, which we'll have you back to really go into more detail about that.
Sure.
But if you're just at home and you want to start composting, how important is it that you have to have sort of that special, I know they have a special barrel and something you can use. Mm-hmm. I know I used to live in a place where I could just go out sort of in a woods near the back of my house, and we started a nice compost pile with leaves. But what do you do for the more urban person who wants to start to compost?
Yeah, there's a lot of barrels and bins that are out there now for an urban environment. If you don't want to have an unsightly, quote-unquote, compost pile in the corner of your yard, you can stuff all the organic matter in there and then keep it turned. And it works pretty well. It actually can turn organic matter into compost within a month or so, during the summer at least. They work really well for a small garden. If you have a bigger garden where there's a lot of stuff you're producing, it's going to be hard to get it all crammed in there because they have a limited capacity. But for a small garden in an urban area, it's a great way to take a lot of that organic matter and to recycle it back into your garden for next year.
So those things that you're pulling, that little leaf really isn't dying. It's not going to nothing because you're putting that bean in your compost.
Right.
And that nice plant.
Nothing ever gets created and destroyed. Isn't that one of the laws of thermodynamics or something like that?
I think so.
But you do have to remember, though, with things like late blight, for example, or any other diseases, if you have really heavily diseased plants or really heavily insect-infested plants, you probably don't want to compost those.
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're really willing to be an expert composter and get the temperatures up to 130, 140, those diseases and insects will survive and they'll come back to reinfect your plant next year.
That's really good advice to make sure. And what do you suggest people do with that matter, those things that are somewhat infected? Or...
Well, there's two things you can do. One, you can put them in garbage bags and send them off to the landfill. I usually don't like people doing that with organic matter, but in this case, it makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
If you have the room, though, you can bury them. If you can bury things down a couple feet into the soil, that will keep the spores down deep, so that when you turn the soil next year, you're not turning them back up to where the new plants are.
So just make sure they're deep enough that you won't be grabbing them again.
Right.
Well, as usual, we could talk to Charlie for a month also, but we're just about out of time. I want to thank him for joining us, and we'll definitely be having him back on the show in the future, and we'll talk about all sorts of other topics going into the fall. So I want to thank you all for joining us and encourage you to write to Deborah at ediblegreenmountains.com if you have anything you'd like us to talk about or cover. Thanks again to our sponsor, Hearst Ranch, and our host, Merrill Lynch, and their beautiful Burlington studios. And tune in next Monday when Kate Manchester, the publisher of Edible Santa Fe, will be your host. So until next time, thanks to all my guests, and enjoy.